Well, let's start with the first five chapters, actually with the foreword.
One
question.
The picture you used for the study guide.
Yes. I think there was. I mean, I don't think he knew it, but go ahead. Oh, he made three?
I think he had a constant ongoing thing going on. Yeah, a constant.
I think he is a vessel for this material, period. Van Gogh, what was the question?
Since you chose this painting, cover, did you see a connection?
Yeah.
I hear you.
Well, what I like about it is, of course, the stars. And they are reflected in the river. And if you look, that light in the river is a mixture of the light from the town and the light from the stars. And see, that's what Sophia is. Sophia is that mixture of the divine light, so to speak, in our daily affairs here on Earth. I just thought it was an amazing picture.
And the man and the woman.
And the man and the woman.
Speaking of images and paintings, though, there's a series of drawings on the Alchemy website called the Aurora Consurgens. It seems to be dated after this text would have been
Could you send me a link for that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think you got a list on the Alchemy website. I think it's on that. But yeah, I'll do that.
Which one was it? I don't remember it, Tom.
Okay. The Alchemy website, yeah, levity.com, that one.
Okay.
Type in a search engine.
Just type in Aurora.
Type in Aurora.
Okay.
There's a series of images.
Might nice to pick up, I think.
Yeah.
By the way, this is a work in progress, so there's going to be plenty of mistakes in this thing, and there's plenty of room for suggestions and so on. So, and if you do have questions, I hope you stop us and ask it. Don't let us run on if you don't understand or don't like something. It's one of the values of the fact that we take our time, that we can give some time to talking and making sure everybody's clear and not only understanding what we're doing, but why we're doing it. Very importantly. So any other comments or questions? Okay, let's just look at Roman numeral 9. Remember, these first couple of chapters we're going to zoom through, so we do slow down eventually. Although today we'll make another detour before we do move on very far, and that will take up some time. Roman numeral 9. Forward to the English edition.
Page.
Roman numeral 9.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you did give us a page. Roman numeral 9 is a page. Okay.
IX.
You want the bottom of the page now,
right. They're all at the bottom of the page. Oh, I see. Yeah, I didn't realize there were different Roman numerals. Three, five lines down. She's talking about the secret of alchemy. The secret has to do, see where I am? The secret has to do with the relation of the unconscious psyche to inorganic matter. Now, how do we find that important? Synchronicity, right? So alchemy was aware that the spiritual world wasn't just spiritual, it was also embedded in matter. And we're going to look at the history of that in a moment. But the alchemists thought when they transformed their material in that retort, the world would change. And, of course, that idea has been thrown out as magical thinking. But we know there's another level in which it's true. And that's one reason why Jung wants to study the alchemist, to see how does the psyche symbolize that knowledge. That somehow matter outside and what goes on in our soul aren't two different things. As Jung will eventually come to say, they're two different expressions of the same thing. And, of course, we're going to see that in this book, because in the seven parables, it's an alchemical reaction on the part of, I'm going to say Thomas, on Thomas's psyche to make this material real. So we'll also be looking at the alchemical worldview. So the secret has to do with the relation of the unconscious psyche to inorganic matter and to the unitary reality, which may be surmised as being their common substrate. Now, how do we talk about the two ways that that unitary reality exists? Just a little pop quiz here. What was the unitary reality in the first way we talked about it? Yeah, that's one way. The two ways would be our hypothesis that your story inside you is prior to your experience and it's coherent. There is a unity of your life inside as a potentiality.
Our hypothesis, our story inside you is prior to your experience and what?
And it's a unity. It's coherent. It's not a mess. It only looks like a mess until you get to know that story.
In other words, it's what we came in with.
To put it very simply, what we came in with, and it's a one piece.
And what they tried to knock out of us.
And what they tried to knock out of us. And generally succeeded, otherwise they couldn't make a living. Yeah. You can't get very far lying in therapy. The poltergeist. The other way that we hypothesize or extrapolate from experience the hypothesis that unity shows up in synchronicities. That at certain moments, when that story, when that unitary story is trying to communicate itself to you, I'm using kind of strange language. It's not quite that. It's not quite accurate to put it that way, but I think it's good enough for our purposes. When that story is trying to communicate itself to you, bits of it will appear. Bits of it in a symbolic form will appear in the material world. And then that leads then to the phrase, the common substrate. That what it forced Jung to, and Pauli also, we've talked a little bit about that, but let's stay with Jung, is that there is another dimension of reality that we just don't know about. Or we may experience it, but we do not know how to conceptualize it. Science can't conceptualize it. Psychology can describe it, but it can't really explain it. And that is that somehow the inner world and the outer world somewhere are the same thing.
Is it that they're the same, or is that they're in communication or in relation?
Well, two sides of the same coin might be a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, more in the direction of that there aren't two worlds. There's one world. We just see them as two worlds. And, you know, given that we're all egocentric creatures, we see, that synchronicity sometimes out there reflects what's going on inside of me. But we rarely say, what's going on inside me might be a reflection of something that's out there. And that's a little bit more, that's more towards what Jung, at the end of his life, was at least positing with this physicist Pauli, that neither physics nor psychology have this conceptually in their system, but if you look at the facts, it's very possible that there is this other dimension of reality. How are we ever going to investigate it? We don't know. But what we've got in this text is this reality symbolized. Sophia will be this reality symbolized.
Well, one of the problematic formulations that is sort of making the rounds is that we create our own reality. And if someone at face value sort of took what you just said, he could be heard as a justification of that kind of simplistic formulation, by the way.
Actually, it's just the opposite, that our reality makes us.
Well, you were saying that the things that go on in here also influence the reflection. Things that go on in the outside world are a reflection of what's going on in here.
Yeah, but then I said what they really came to was that what's going on in here is a reflection of what's going on in this other place. Mm-hmm. Or to be more accurate, that there is a dimension which, again, we just give it a word, mm-hmm. that might lie behind images appearing on the outside, on the inside, and neither one is prior to the other, but both partake in this other reality. And again, it's a hypothesis they formulated. That's all the fault you can go with. Where do you go from there? Who knows? But what I think you can do then is see, has the psyche produced images to suggest the same thing? And that's what this book is then. It's an attempt to look at the images the psyche has produced, which could be a symbolic representation of what this reality is.
Jerry, is the way to think about that, you know, if we go back to the beginning of time, we were all sort of one big primal stew, so to speak. So the humans didn't see subject-object at that point.
Right.
They just participated in what happened.
Right.
And so what Raven meant to them was very different than us because they were part of all of it. So we spent all these thousands of years now separating from that world, trying
mm-hmm.
to gaining a consciousness which
mm-hmm.
then created the subject-object.
Absolutely.
In some ways, what we're trying to do now is to go back.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Completely. I would say not in some ways. That's what we are trying to do.
So we're trying to now, but with a consciousness that we have.
But in a way that is not in conflict with the conscious standpoint.
And masculine, especially differentiated, separated off and contained the feminine
mm-hmm.
in a repressed way. So then you get these things erupting through time.
Saying, hey, here I am.
Right. And now what we're trying to do is consciously engage the feminine in a whole variety of ways.
And then let that shape the rational standpoint.
Right. That interplay then, because it is all one.
Mm-hmm.
Try to talk about it in either way, like as you were trying to describe it, it's hard because to put words around what it really is.
You can't. I don't think you can. At the moment, I think the best we can do is see it in images. You know, those of you who have done dream work, you know how you'll get a new insight before you understand it as an image. I think that's what we've got here in Sophia. It's an image of a new worldview. And we're just trying to circumscribe it.
So we can consciously participate with it? I mean, is that fair to add that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even though just because you don't understand it doesn't mean you can't participate in it.
Right.
In fact, I think that's one of the key goals of our work is to help people realize how far this symbolic dimension goes and to respond to it, whether it appears internally or externally.
Yes, to reintegrate the unconscious consciously.
Mm-hmm.
We were unconscious. We gain consciousness by developing duality, I, thou, me, it. Now we need to consciously reintegrate this to that to further our consciousness.
What was I going to say? Oh, and to recognize that the material world acts just as much like the unconscious as the dreams do. So that extends the concept of the unconscious to the material world. That's very much Sophia stuff. So, to inorganic matter and to the unitary reality, which may be surmised as being their common substrate. That sound familiar now? That unus mundus, okay, we talked about that. Is that okay? That the one world, which would be that unity in your story and in the fact that symbols can appear, those story symbols can appear inside you or outside you, and it doesn't make any difference. So the idea of taking the unconscious is that as it is something inside you is false. And Jung described that last chapter of Mysterium. I brought that paragraph along. We'll look at that later. It seems to me that with every year, the progress of the physical sciences is catching up with the bold results of Jung's pioneer work. And what I was saying, that we're not just... working alone here. Physics is drawn to the same conclusions when sensitive physicists examine phenomena as psychology is when we examine certain phenomena. So that this book, in a funny way, is about the rapprochement of physics and psychology, in a funny way of putting it. Because Sophia is their common ground. It seems to me that with every year, the progress of the physical sciences is catching up with the bold results of Jung's pioneer work, and that the time draws nearer when the psychophysical unitary reality, big words but important words, psychophysical unitary reality. You see why they say that? Mm-hmm. Everybody happy with that? Mm-hmm. Another way to then say that Sophia is an image of the psychophysical unitary reality. Will assume a form that may be apprehended by the intellect, even though it cannot be visualized concretely. So that's the kind of the book in a nutshell. And then what breaks into Thomas is an image of the psychophysical unitary reality. Okay? Well, now we go on another excursion. 155. We start the book. Let me just skim for you this is the first chapter, by the way, of the book. And before she starts in on an image, she gives us some background information on wisdom. I want to take what she says and enlarge on it a little bit. So let's just look at what she says. Remember, wisdom is not a Jungian invention. It goes back to the Greeks and the Hebrews. Where you find it biblically on page 155, and we'll look at the text in a moment, in the book of Proverbs, wisdom appears. They didn't teach you this in Sunday school, but she's there. Ecclesiasticus and the wisdom of Solomon. And we'll come back to this idea. Just hang on to it for a moment. In patristic literature, now patristic literature is the church fathers, those guys that wrote for the first couple hundred years. She was mostly interpreted as Christ. Of course, she's not the same as Christ. She's going to be different. But they tried to lump it all in one thing because there wasn't room for these. Wasn't room then to see the physical world symbolically. The pre-existent logos. Now, that's kind of a conception of Christ in the book of John. We'll talk about that later. Or as the sum of the eternal forms of the self-knowing primordial causes. We talked about that a little bit. Does that sound familiar? In other words, that in their idea, Sophia was the forms in God by which God created things. In the medieval mind. Each tradition is going to take this experience and try to shove it in their own little compartment. Around 156, We're going to talk about it as the feminine personification of the collective unconscious. Again, this is still pretty introductory. Don't worry if it doesn't make sense. It'll hopefully make sense when I go through a historical excursion on who she is.
Feminine personification of the collective unconscious. An aspect, but
only... It's only an aspect, yeah. I don't particularly care for that. She said a feminine personification of the collective unconscious, but only an aspect. I said yes. Then I said, I don't particularly care for that understanding of it. But
what do you mean, Gary, you don't care for that?
Well, it's a specific aspect of the feminine aspect of the collective unconscious. It's too general for my tastes.
So you don't like the way it's defined here, or?
But it's too broad.
It's too broad here this definition?
Yeah. But she's just getting going, so it's not an important point.
Isn't that idea through which God becomes conscious of himself an essential piece in terms of how this is viewed? I mean, that through us and the work that we are doing here, God is coming to know him, her, itself.
Yeah, hang on to that. We will definitely look at that. It's very important. What I'm doing, I'm just going through her very brief commentary. Then we're going to go back and look at each of these points in more details. I think of just a little schematic. I'm just trying to get you acquainted with her, with her lay of the land. And then she talks over on 157. That the in the Middle Ages, the alchemists saw Sophia as the soul in matter. That gets closer to our understanding of it. Now, she's just giving you a very brief historical survey. I want to give you a little more careful historical survey. I think this is just a little sketchy. So we'll come back to this, but let's go to the study guide. Page 26. But I forget what we said here. I just did this to equate you terms. Now we'll look at it more closely, and hopefully the study guide will make the book more clear. So I'm going to go through quite a few pages with you on leaving Jung out of it. How has the history of religions and the history of culture seen Sophia? Well, let me give you a quick outline of what we'll be doing. We'll be looking at how the Jews saw Sophia. And we'll look at how the Greeks saw Sophia. That's really the first two places she appears, in the Old Testament and in Greek philosophy, around 500 BC. The next main place she appears is in Gnosticism. And that's around, I'll say, the birth of Christ-ish. The next place she appears is in medieval philosophy and alchemy. See, each of these traditions has this, knows there's this experience around, and they all try to express it in a way consonant with their own tradition.
And you have the Native Americans with Buffalo Woman.
I'm not aware of that so much, but perhaps you could contribute it if you'd like. The other, then, we eventually come to is Jungian psychology. And we're going to look at each of those traditions.
And you're lumping medieval philosophy and alchemy together.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same worldview. Let's go to Wisdom in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament. Now, what I've done on page 26 and 27, I've just gone to a classic college textbook on the Old Testament. And I looked up what they said about wisdom. first thing he points out that it's a Greek origin. We'll come back to that. Philosophia. Philosophy has as its etymology Sophia, love of wisdom. And it reached its maturity around 460 to 430. BC in the Greeks. And the philosophical understanding of wisdom is that it is the quest for the meaning of life. Well, that sounds awfully close to what we're talking about. Now this came up, I think, John, you raised this question. Aren't there typically, aren't there a couple dimensions of Sophia? Yes, there are. Wisdom literature, that would be wisdom as she appears in those books I mentioned, the Proverbs, etc., sometimes is just good practical advice. And sometimes wisdom is a response in an articulation of the anguish and despair at living a meaningful life. That's the way we're going to be talking about it. That wisdom is a response to anguish. Wisdom speaks to anguish. Wisdom isn't how do you tie your goat up. Wisdom is how do you make sense of tragedy. But she has these, biblically she has these two aspects.
And what are these references here? This 568, 569?
Oh, that's in the, I just typed it up from the book.
Okay.
The book is Bernard Anderson, Understanding the Old Testament.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's freshman Old Testament religion course book. I guess about everybody used, I don't know if they still used to use it. Now I'm skipping down, you can read out at your leisure if you like, but I'm going to skip down at the bottom of the page to the bold. In the Old Testament understanding, wisdom represented the divine order of things written into the nature of life. And it can be found through reflection and searching.
What is that?
The bottom of 26. The bold are mine. Well, that's very close to what we're talking about. So the way we're working with Sophia is very close to the Hebrew meaning. That there is an order. Now, of course, they saw it in terms of the whole world. We're seeing it in terms of both ourselves in the world. But it is very consistent with the idea of Sophia biblically. And it has to be found through effort. So you see, that's a difference between Sophia and Yahweh. Yahweh comes to meet you. You have to go meet Sophia. Yahweh gives you a free lunch sometimes, but Sophia never gives you a free lunch. Around 27, just touching the main point, as I say, you can read this at your leisure. Second paragraph there, the last two lines. Wisdom is not just the key to proper ethical behavior. That would be the mundane aspect. But it seeks to grasp the secret of the divine plan behind the whole of creation. Again, now I'm simply giving you in biblical language what we talked about conceptually when we went through number and time. And what was implied when we worked with those dreams. This in Jungian psychology is called circumambulation. We're just walking around from many different traditions looking at the explanations of more or less the same phenomenon. Because each tradition gives us a little piece of it. a symbol cannot be grasped in one explanation. That's why you have to go to so many different traditions, because each one's got a little piece of it. The next line down, again, remember, this is classical Old Testament theology. Wisdom is not just a human capacity. Wisdom is personified as the agent of God. Which means that this, in our language, what we were saying before, this wisdom is a knower in you. It's not something you know, it's something that knows you. There's a reversal of centrality. In the biblical language, she's an aspect of God. Now, the classic text in which she introduces herself is in Proverbs 8. Let's just read that. If you want, on page 31, I've given you another version of it. We don't have to read both. I'll just read the one. But this is wisdom speaking. Proverbs 8. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. So see, the idea is that Sophia is there before creation. By the way, the Hebrew word for Sophia is Chochmah, and the Greek is Sophia, and the English is wisdom, and the Latin is sapientia. So they're all different words for the same thing. So the Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. You can see how they get the idea of this forms in the mind of God. Of course, we're talking about that as forms for your life. We're taking that as a metaphor. But also knowing how that form can extend to the world itself when we're dealing with synchronicity. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him, like a master workman. And I guess the Hebrew is ambiguous. The alternative translation is like a little child. And I was his daily delight. There comes the erotic aspect that Sophia is his paramour, which you get in the traditions. Rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the sons of men. So all of this starts from that passage. And I've given you other places where Sophia appears in the Old Testament. You can read that or not as you care to. But the basic idea, I think, is summed up from the Old Testament standpoint. Page 28 there in the bold. Sophia is the cosmic pre-existent wisdom. See, it always is pre-existent. Pre-existent to Yahweh. Pre-existent to your life.
Pre-existent to Yahweh? Mm-hmm.
Pre-existent to the creation of the world.
Because of the Lord created.
Yeah, pre-existent to the creation of the world.
And actually, from what I was taught, once that El Shaddai, a lot of like Abraham knew God as El Shaddai, big breasted. So, obviously, they knew God more in the feminine aspect before the Yahweh, the warring.
Right.
Yeah. because she was the creator, which the feminine is, and mm-hmm. the Christian God took it all away and mm-hmm. was the creator of Euclid.
Mm-hmm. So, again, circumambulating, hearing it from thoughts, from dreams, now from the Old Testament. A little bit more on the Old Testament, page 29. This is from Mettinger's The Bible and the Psyche. And he did this work, which I think is very interesting. He made three columns. Actually, I don't think it's his making. This is standard divisions in the Old Testament. There's the historical books, and the poetical wisdom books, and the prophetic books. See, we hear about Sophia first in the Bible, after the book of Job. Jung didn't think that was an accident. In the book of Job, for the first time, now this is Edinger's interpretation of it, for the first time, Yahweh confronts an individual as an individual. He confronted individuals before in the Old Testament, but always as representative of the nation. It's the first time God confronts a human being as an individual. And that confrontation was an onslaught. And Job held his own against it. And in Jung's interpretation of the book of Job, that's what got Yahweh to remember Sophia. And that's why Proverbs appears after Job. Biblical scholars might say, well, it's simply the way the books were divided up. Edinger and Jung are taking that division as meaningful, that it's showing us something, that Sophia comes about after a confrontation with the dark stuff. When you are assaulted by the brutality of a power drive and you don't succumb, then you generate wisdom, would be another way to put it. When you're assaulted by a power drive, when you're the victim of injustice, power injustice, and you don't succumb to passing it on, which is always the temptation, that the victim becomes the persecutor. Victim in one generation becomes the persecutor in the next generation. If you are able to witness the injustice and endure the onslaught without becoming vindictive, what you generate is Sophia. It's a psychological truth. And that's what Job represents, is that evolving level of consciousness, which is the prerequisite of being able to enter into a relationship with Sophia.
That's one of the big problems in our modern culture, is I think a lot of our victim therapy denies the person the access.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think almost, wicked sense, purposely denies it.
Absolutely. It's good money in it.
Denies him the ability to
access it. Yeah, because they keep coming back then. Absolutely. Makes me sick. I'm sorry to say, mostly propagated by theologians.
Because we have no salvation except through God. We don't have any self-agency.
Right. We have not reached the point of Job of realizing my judgment is just as good as God's.
We have a self-agency.
Exactly.
Participate in.
And that they can't. That they can't stand. Look what they did to Matthew Fox. They booted him out of the church. He's that Catholic theologian in Oakland.
Yeah,
he's the guy who, I don't know if he's the first that said that. He's one of the people who say that in our time. Yeah.
Everybody's a victim of something in our culture. It's portrayed like that. You're anything happens to you, your life, you're a victim of it. And the response or treatment is not that that it's not your fault, which in most cases it's not your fault, but it's that you shouldn't even have to reflect on it or think about it or deal with it.
It's a blaming psychology. They help you feel good about blaming.
Find space.
You know. Exactly. This is Answer to Job. I heartily recommend it, and the study guide. That's what it's talked about. Because Job is a victim of horrible abuse, but he stands his ground. And in Jung's mind, that is what generates Sophia. And why that's so important for our work, it goes along with the salmon theme, the collecting the board games theme, the mean, remember the mean bully image? Sophia is a result of a confrontation. It is, again, not something that just is given to you. It's something that emerges out of a struggle. And we're going to see that again and again. And that's where it's different from Yahweh and from the New Testament God.
So Sophia is in the messes?
Sophia is in the messes.
What?
Is in the messes.
Oh, in the messes.
Didn't Jung say God is in the messes, or somebody said that Sophia is there?
Yeah.
Well, even that dream that you have in the beginning, that's the whole beginning, that she is in it, you know.
Right.
You know, look at the mess.
Right.
Or whatever, or confused.
Right. Right. And that's what I typed down there at the bottom of 29. Yeah, Jung, the counter between Yahweh and Job in Jung's mind causes Yahweh to remember his feminine divine counterpart, divine wisdom, Sophia. And it's the same Sophia we'll be talking about. Well, I think we better, to get into this Gnosticism, will take too long. Carol, very kindly brought a picture along. You might bring that back next week. We've gotten through the Old Testament. We'll look at Gnosticism, the place of Sophia in Gnosticism, and then we'll look at, Edinger's given us just a nice canvas throughout history of Sophia. That's page 31 and 32 and 33. We'll do that. And then that will be the end of that excursion. We'll go back then to the study guide on page 157. How much to read? I would say you could probably read, we're not going to get through them, but if you don't mind reading ahead a little bit, go as far as you can up through chapter 5.
In the book.
And don't, you know, we're going to go through this very quickly, so don't feel you have to get everything. I'm just picking out the main descriptions of Sophia. We might take a week or two to get through that, and then we'll get into the book where we'll grind down and go really sentence by sentence. So we're slowly moving at our introduction into getting into the text and going through it. Careful.
How do you spell Hachma?
I think it's H-O-C-H-M-A. That's the transliterated.
And that's Hebrew.
That's Hebrew for wisdom. H-O-C-H? H-O-C-H-M-A?
They dropped the first C in studying Kabbalah.
How do they spell it then?
Just H-O-C-H-M-A-H.
H-O-C-H-M-A-H.
Okay. And then wisdom was the biblical?
Wisdom is English.
Oh, English. Okay.
Sophia is Greek.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to get that one.
And Sapientia? S-A-P-I-E-N-T-I-A? D-E-I, Dei.
S-I-P-E-N-D-I.
T-I-A.
T-I-A.
We'll go through that again. So, Chochmah, Sophia, Sapientia, Dei, and wisdom, all the same, depending on what era of history you're dealing with. Okay, thank you. See you in 2.